Take me where the promises are real.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic.
Tinsley.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This is a reading based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. So tonight is the first time I've met the speaker, but I did notice on the poster that his sobriety date was B.C., which is before cell phones, and I'm really looking forward to what he has to share with us tonight. With that, I'll give you Phil.
Hey, my name's Philip, an alcoholic. First, I want to say this is probably one of my least favorite things to actually do, at least unless I had a six-pack in my system or something. this is the area where I kind of grew up in. I went to grammar school right down the street. I went to high school right down the street. I got my first public drunk right down the street, which is at the Kroger, that red light right there. I got my last public drunk in the Cab County Jail at a Memorial Drive and 285 intersection. And I had a lot of public drunks and a lot of stuff in between. But I was born and raised here in Atlanta, and I was a pretty good kid in grammar school. You know, I went through 7 years and never missed a day of grammar school. I did really well until they put me in charge of like the ice cream money, you know. And then that was where I got caught for the first time stealing, you know, some money for the basket, some money from my pocket, you know, stuff like that. And I don't remember getting any trouble for that, but then I went to high school. You know, in my family, there's a lot of alcoholism in our family. You know, my dad's family, not my mom. My mom's family is like a bunch of saints. But my dad's family, there's like alcoholism everywhere. A lot of his brothers and sisters and stuff, and his dad died in their 30s and 40s. And so my mom used to warn me, my brothers, you know, and sister, what might happen if we started drinking, you know, before we started drinking. And, I don't know, I didn't listen too much to that kind of stuff, you know. So, you know, I was kind of probably, at least in my eyes, kind of a normal kid. I hung around with some guys that liked to do things that probably wasn't perfectly legal, you know. When they did other things, like I started smoking pot and drink a little bit when I was probably the age of 12 or 13 years old. You know, we did other normal stuff. I mean, it wasn't normal to most people, but, you know, you go around stealing stuff. I did that. I mean, I graduated from the grammar school stuff, and we started taking anything that wasn't tied down with a group of guys. And but you know, when I started drinking, though, you know, for starters, my best friend that I met when I was really fairly young was like a career criminal in the making, and I got taught. And I was a guy that had a fairly low self esteem, and I was talked into doing stuff pretty quickly. And so I got in some criminal trouble with doing a variety of things. But when I started drinking, you know, I don't know. It's like it just fixed my self-esteem. It just made me big. It made me, everything about my life, it made better instantly. But my problem wasn't really the drinking part. It was the blackout part. Because when I drank, I blacked out all the time. When I was 13, 14 years old, when I started drinking, I'd wake up in places, you know, all kind of places. Well, the first time I ever got a... The first time I actually got arrested for drinking was when I was 17. I blacked out and I passed out underneath this red light, and I could have easily probably gotten hit by a car or something like that. And I was with this friend of mine, and she had called my mom and said, look, you need to come. It's right over here at this Kroger. So you need to come get him. He's not going to make it home. And I, you know, my mom rushed up there, and then there was a high school hangout we hung out with a lot, a place called Demos Subs. I don't know if anybody ever remembers from that era. And they had a rent-a-cop up there. They had a bunch of high school kids from Cross Keys, where I went to high school then. And, you know, so by the time my mom got there to try to get me before I made it home, I was already in the back of a paddy wagon, you know. And that night, I was 17, and they took me home instead of taking me to jail. But they did the next day. I remember they did give me a citation that said I was arrested for public drunk, and I got to court at a certain date. So, all right. And also, people told me things about that night for a while. And things I did while I was inside of Demos Subs that I'm glad I was probably blacked out. But, you know, a couple days later, I decided that I was going out drinking again. And my mom told me, she's like, look, if you go out and go drinking tonight and you get arrested, you're going to stay in jail all weekend. And I remember thinking, the thing is too, also about blackouts. Is the day that I blacked out, the first time I got arrested, I remember drinking vodka and orange juice and pepper schnapps. And I don't remember a lot else, but I remember starting with that. You know, but that next day, that was on a Tuesday night. And on that Friday night, I was going, I was drinking beer and stuff like that, you know. And I remember me and some buddies of mine were riding through this bowling alley parking lot up here, Northeast Plaza. And the cop pulls us open. There's five of us in this car. And he makes everybody get out of the car but me. And I remember thinking, you know, I thought that was kind of screwed up. I wanted to get out of the car, too. But the cop, in his mind, thought I was drinking too much. And he told the guys that he needed to take me home because I'd been drinking too much. And in my mind, I already knew I wasn't going home. So they got back in the car, and the guys were like, you know, the cops, we really got to take you home. And I already made up my mind I wasn't going home. But I blacked out. And I woke up in the Cab County Jail. And I remember thinking, I had no clue where I got arrested. And so I had to call my mom and say, you know, I got arrested. She's like, well, where'd you get arrested this time? I said, the same place I got arrested last time. Of course, the last time was underneath the red light. So it actually wasn't in that same spot. But I went to court for both of them on the same day, you know, because they were so close together. And I went to court, and the judge says, he said, the first one, you were passed out underneath Claremont Road red light. So obviously you were extremely drunk, and I'm going to give you a year's probation and a $100 fine. He said the second one, which was only 3 days later, he said, you were running from the police officer behind Northeast Plaza Bowling Alley. So obviously you weren't as drunk as you were the first time. So I'm going to give you a $50 fine and a year's probation. I'm thinking, damn, I was clueless. But here's the thing about not drinking, though. I went to court, and I was 17. I've been blacking out since I was probably 13. When I went to court, I didn't think there was any issue. You know, I really didn't. And I didn't go to court thinking I had that big of a problem, you know. But when that judge told me that, I left court and it freaked me out. I didn't drink for 9 months. Because I knew that if I drank, that kind of stuff would continue to happen. I just knew it. I didn't drink for 9 months. I did other substances. But I will tell you, other substances, you know, marijuana, some of this other stuff, it did not do the same thing for me that alcohol did for me. You know, alcohol may be 10 foot tall and bulletproof. And like, you know, as short as I am, I needed to be 10 foot tall. But it literally just made me, everything about my life better. Other substances, it's like a temporary fix. I mean, really temporary. It was nothing like alcohol would do for me. So after about 9 months, I started drinking again because I could only handle so much. But, you know, I'll tell you this. And during this time, you had I got arrested a few times besides the drinking stuff. You know, a few criminal things. I got arrested for, like, auto theft and a few other things. And I was almost, you know, and I was doing pretty good in school considering, you know. But I found a way to make it out of high school. And my mom really thought that, you know, you really need to get in the service. Because, you know, I was a guy that had no plans for life. My first plan was I'm going to go to the military, I'm going to spend 20 years, and I'm going to retire. That was like my plan. So I tried to get in the Army. And the Army, they ran like 6 or 7 waivers on me, and they finally said, you know what, if you could stay out of trouble another 18 months, we'll take you. And so I figured, you know, I didn't really want to go in the Navy, you know, for some reason. But my mom decided, without really telling me, she took all the waivers that I had and went and talked to a Navy recruiter. And I don't know what she said to them, but they're like, you know, we'll take them. She tells me, okay, you know, I got you in the Navy. You can, so you can actually get out of here. And I think what she really wanted to do was to get me away from some of these idiots I was hanging out with. Not to mention the drinking part. I think she probably thought it'd probably help me grow up or something, you know. So next thing you know, I found myself going in the Navy. And I'm going to tell you this. If you're going to the Navy and you got a pretty bad drinking problem and blacking out problem and stuff like that, it doesn't really fix that. When I first went in the military in the Navy, I did really well in the boot camp because I was not allowed to drink in boot camp. and then what they do is when you get out of boot camp is they pay you, you know. And then when they pay you, it means I have money, and it's time to start drinking again. and my career is, you know, I was never a really good sailor, but I remember when I came home from boot camp. And I actually got paid. And I'd go out and I would recklessly go out drinking a lot of my dress white Cracker Jack uniforms and all this kind of stuff. I ruined 5 sets of uniforms before I went to my first base. I'd literally go out getting drunk. I'd black out and rolling in mud, stuff like that. So I show up. I got stationed in Charleston, South Carolina. You know, so I go to... My very first day in Charleston, South Carolina, they paid me when I got there, and I thought, you know, I got to see what this town's like. You know, we go to this, so they got this bus that kind of takes you all over town. You know, it's like a school bus. And, you know, you can kind of go from bar to bar or whatever. You know, I thought it was pretty cool, except I didn't know nothing about Charleston, but I decided to take this bus. You know, and the thing is, I'm not really supposed to report until the next day, you know. And the division I was in was called the Small Boats Division, which was a barge tied up next to the pier that looked after boats. You know, of course, I didn't really know all that much about boats, you know, or anything. I mean, I'd never reported there, and I wasn't supposed to report until the next day. Except, you know, I went out drinking, and I woke up on the side of this. I don't know where. I woke up on this bench or something. You know, and I'm thinking. And I was supposed to be at work in like an hour ahead. Within a couple hours, I was supposed to be at work. But I had no idea where I was at. So I remember, I just started hitchhiking. And back in those days, you could hitchhike and people would actually give you a ride. You know, so I started hitchhiking and some guy gives me a ride. And he's like, you know, he was actually going to my ship. You know, so it actually made that part quick. But then again, I show up when I'm walking up to my... my barge where my division was, their mess room for quarters. I'm half drunk the night before in my civilian clothes, and their thought was, oh shit, we got another one. that was my first impression with these guys, you know. And you know, it really didn't get any better than that. you know, my drinking just kind of took off, you know. But you know what? I found out that when I got there, there was this big Liberty cruise coming up. You know, so, and this Liberty cruise was going, so actually I was on a boat called a USS Canopus. It was a giant submarine tender, and we never went anywhere. It just kind of stayed in shore. Then it would go out to sea like one week a year, tear up a couple times, and come back. And that was about the extent of their trips. But when I got there, they were planning a trip to Fort Lauderdale for spring break. And I thought, man, what kind of perfect timing is that? You know, I am finally getting a boat. I've never been to Fort Lauderdale, so I'm thinking... This ought to be fun. Get to go to Fort Lauderdale for spring break. Except, you know, I was just having a regular, normal day hanging out at the military club, and I'm watching the cops arrest this guy, and I'm like half in, half out, blacking out. And next thing you know, I wake up in the military jail, and I could always come out of a blackout, usually like running off at the mouth or something, just cussing people out and just really, you know, just but my chief petty officer had come to pick me up, and he walks in carrying a pair of shackles and handcuffs. And he's like, well, they told me they had some kind of a crazy lunatic in here. And it's only you. Like, it's really so it turned out that I was arrested for like assaulting a police officer. assaulting a police officer, resisting arrest, public drunk. Just, the thing is, I just made E1, I mean E2. I mean, I never really made it past E2. So I went from E1 to E2, then I get arrested, I get busted back to E1 again. They bust me like a half month's pay for 2 months, restricted the ship for 45 days, all this stuff. So when we went to Fort Lauderdale for spring break, I couldn't even get off the ship. I was stuck on the ship with a giant yellow ID card. You know, it's just kind of like that. So I was in Charleston, South Carolina for about 18 months, and I had about 9 public drunks, a DUI, assault of a police officer, and a driving without a license or something. But I, you know, the thing is, I got let go a lot more than I ever got caught. This is like a regular ordeal. Stuff like that was always happening, you know. And so the military started thinking, you know, maybe he's got an issue, you know. So they sent me to it's probably like a modern day DUI school, like for a week, you know, where in the afternoons I had to go there. And I think what they want to do is to teach you how to drink successfully or something, you know. And I don't remember that much about it, but I don't think it worked. So I went through that, and then they would send me to the chaplain occasionally, you know, and then our ship was coming up on we're getting ready to get put in dry dock, you know, and like I said, I'd never made past E2. I went E1, E2. I mean, it's just kind of a circle, you know. But our ship was getting ready to go to dry dock, and they decided we started working in dry dock, and they decided they wanted to send me to a treatment center, the military treatment center, which is by far the best treatment center you can go to because I got paid to go. I got my regular check to go to treatment. So, but I remember when I went to this treatment center, before I went to this treatment center, I found out. Now, a lot of my arrests, I didn't get double jeopardy on. They were away from the base, and I didn't really get caught by the military, and so I just basically had to pay fines and stuff like that. And I'd only been to 2 captain's mess, but I got let go on a couple others that could have been captain's mess. And I found out that if you go to this treatment center, and they got this 6-month aftercare program after the treatment center, and you tell them to kiss your rear on the aftercare program, you can get out with an honorable discharge. It's actually the worst honorable you can get, but it's a general and honorable conditions. So my first major plan, after my first plan of actually trying to retire from the service, I thought I'd go to this treatment center, and I'd tell them to kiss my rear on aftercare and get out with an honorable discharge. So I called my mom and said, hey, I'm coming home. This is what I'm going to do. Told her what my plan was. And you know what? Our division, some guys in our division decided they were going to have a party for some reason. And so, you know, the way my mind works is, you know what? If I'm going to be locked up for 30 days, I'm damn sure not missing this party. So we go to this party, and we wanted to carry the party over to some guy's house. So the thing is, when you're in the Navy and you go to other bases, you really got to be on your P's and you got to be on your better behavior. And you're like, if you go to the Air Force Base, well, the Air Force Base had the biggest liquor store in Charleston at the time. And so we had to go to the Air Force Base to buy some more beer and liquor for the party to take it to this guy's house. So we go to this liquor store. And I remember I'm standing in line. I got 2 cases of beer. I'm at the cash register, just about ready to pay to get out of this place. Well, I blacked out and up in the Air Force Base jail. they like to take one charge and they'll give it like 5 different names, you know. And so I come out of there. They, you know, had a bunch of charges. Something, you know what? When I go to this treatment center, they're gonna wipe all this stuff out because I'm trying to get sober, you know, which is a bunch of crock. So that was my plan. I thought, well, maybe I still got a chance for my plan to work, right? So I go to this treatment center the week later, right? Because I hadn't gotten in trouble for the stuff on Air Force Base yet. So I'm in treatment center, and you know, that's where I went to my first AA meetings. I didn't go to treatment because I wanted to quit drinking. I didn't go to treatment. I didn't know if I had that big of a problem yet. I mean, I'm only like 21 years old, you know. So when I go to this treatment center, they took me to my first AA meetings. We went in the vans, and they were picking up white. I mean, they really wanted you to pick up a white chip and start doing something. It took me like I'm going to tell you something. I had a hard time even saying my name and alcoholic in the same sentence, in the same phrase. But yet, other people called me alcoholic that I was in a Navy with. It's like I didn't mind that because it justified the crazy behavior that was going on, you know. But I didn't like calling myself an alcoholic, you know. So for a couple of weeks, it took me a couple of weeks to even say my name an alcoholic in a meeting, you know, after being in the military. And but they took the meetings every day. You know, and I really identified more than I really wanted to. You know, there was a lot of stuff they were talking about that was me perfectly. You know, but, you know, and then they came up with this, the third weekend of treatment, they had the third weekend of treatment, they had this weekend liberty thing where they let you out for a weekend. They said, whatever you do, don't go hang out with your buddies in the bars, you know, whatever. And I can't remember exactly how they worded it. And I'm like, hey, not a problem. Well, first thing I did was, I mean, it was a buddy of mine. And I said, look, man, if you get too drunk, let me know, I'll drive for you. So the dude gets drunk as a skunk. I'm driving for him. He talks to me doing his U-turn. I do his U-turn. A cop pulls over. Next to the dude's like cussing the cop out, running off of the mouth. He's caught with dope on him. He's drunk as a skunk. And the cop thought I was even drunk. Of course, I was 3 weeks sober. You know, right the trip. And then the cop said, you know, you got a suspended driver's license, right? And I said, you know, I completely forgot about that. He says, tell you what. I said, well, are you going to give me a ticket? He's like, oh, no, you got to go to jail. So I went to jail for my weekend liberty out of the treatment center. And then somehow I got out like early Sunday morning, and we go back in this treatment center, and you sit around in a circle and tell everybody, what did you do for your weekend liberty? You know, and I was the only one that spent in jail. And it's just a really weird time. It's like, so I'm getting out of the treatment center. And the thing is, They asked me, do you have any fear about getting out of treatment center? And you know what? I didn't have any. And I know now that I didn't have any because I really didn't want to quit drinking. You know, it just never dawned on me that I had to really quit completely drinking. So I get out of the treatment center. It took me a couple of days to start drinking again. The Navy busted me for the stuff I did on the Air Force Base. Made my third captain's mess. And then what they do when they restrict you to the ship, they give you 5 restricted musters, you know, a day. So they want to make sure you're not going where you're not going AWOL. And usually what they do, if you miss one, they slap you on the wrist. You miss 2, they'll give you some extra duty. You miss, it takes like 3 or 4 misses to actually write you up. But, you know, they didn't like me very much. I was so ticked that they had busted me that I just didn't even hear them call it. So I missed the very first one, and they decided to write me up. Made my 4th captain's mess, and so they ended up kicking me out with a dishonorable discharge, which was December 6th of 1984. And they didn't give me enough money for the bus home. Now, ironically, that's also the day of my last public drunk, which was my last public drunk was Memorial Drive in 285, which was December 6th, 1984, which is the day I came home from the service. You know, and I didn't plan on that either. You know, it's just. Yeah, I didn't plan on any of this stuff. But, you know, I remember, I don't go to the deep, it's just one thing after another, it seemed like. But, you know, after I'd gotten out of the service and I got this other public drunk, I went like almost I went a whole year and didn't get arrested. But I got let go like 5 times. It was just a really weird year where I just kept getting let go for stuff. And then that was in Atlanta. I mean, today's day, they probably get commissioned on stuff. They probably let you go for nothing nowadays. But back then, they did. So let me go for stuff. But and I'll tell you this. I still didn't look at myself as an alcoholic, even though I had a history that says, you probably are, you know. But, you know, me and my kid brother was riding, and I don't even know how he knew this. We were riding in front of NABBA one day, and he said, you see that? That's NABBA. That's the AA club. I don't know how he knew that. And I said, yeah, I'm going to be in that sucker. I had this gut feeling that I was going to be here, and I don't know why I just did, you know. And I was looking for a job, and I got a job right next door to NABBA. at Baron Incorporated, right next door. And they put me working with a guy named Marcus, who just so happened to be 9 months old. It's just the weirdest thing. And so he kept telling me about AA and NABA and all this kind of stuff. And then he told me the magic words. He said, you know, they got a couple of pool tables over there. I'm like, really? So me and my kid brother came to NABA the first time because I wanted to see what the pool tables were. You know, we came here, I think it was like a Tuesday night or something. And I really walked in. I don't know, they were talking about some crap that I heard in the treatment center. So I wasn't really that serious. I wasn't really thinking about really paying attention, you know. But I looked around. I didn't see the tables. There's at least one person here I thought that looked like they were drunk. And it turned out she wasn't, because I got to know her later. Name was Katie. So we left that night and got drunk, you know. I was living with him and my little brother's wife, and a couple of months later, I just got to appoint my wife. I thought, you know, I was 22 then, and I thought, if I could just quit drinking, I thought my life would get off the ground. It seemed like everything I touched just turned to shit. You know, I just couldn't, and that's the first time I think I truly, in my heart, I blamed it on what I was doing and alcohol and all that, the whole life. And yeah, I did other drugs, but the alcohol was my main thing, period, you know. And so I really thought that. And somehow I came back up to NABA. You know, I picked a white chip up, and I was sitting right over here on the whaling wall, what we used to call it, you know, the wall over there. And, I met a guy, his name was Brent, and he kind of explained a few things to me and volunteered to be my sponsor. He took me downstairs, bought me lunch downstairs, and you know what? That's where the damn pool tables were. They have hidden from me. You know, but I remember thought, you know, that was pretty cool, you know. And he kind of told me about, I don't know, a variety of things about what they do to stay sober. And I mean, you know what? You haven't heard me talk about church and God and stuff like that, because I just wasn't one of those kind of people. But for some reason, this guy was talking to me about hitting your knees in the morning and night. That's like, you know, I have no idea why I started doing that stuff in the beginning. You know, I thought maybe they wouldn't let me stay here if I didn't, you know. But I started doing things, you know, and I started going to a ton of meetings. But I remember this, is I was living with my little brother and his wife, and I didn't have a car or a driver license. And I remember he told me, hey, I tell you, one of the best things he did, he got me plugged in some really strong AA meetings. Skyline became my home group for a really long time. But he took me to a lot of these places. But I remember he said, I'll come pick you up tomorrow at whatever time it was, like 7:30 or 7 or something like that. And I remember looking out the blinds thinking that joker ain't showed up. That was my mindset, you know. And he showed up exactly when he said he was going to show up, you know. So he picked me up and started taking me to all these really strong AA meetings. You know, and he taught me things like, you know what, every time you go to a meeting, there's three meetings. You go to the meeting beforehand, during, and after. You know, if there's a place that's getting together for breakfast or lunch, you be there. You know what I'm saying? Even if you're not eating, you go there, you know. You know, and I wasn't a person that develops bonds with people. You know, stuff like that, you know, kind of, it helped me tons, you know. And he got me started on trying to work something. Let me tell you this. the thing about, you know, when hitting my knees in the morning and night, that's completely out of my character to an extreme. I'd never done anything. I quit going to church when I was like 5 or 6 years old because my mom caught me skipping Sunday school and said, you don't want to go, you don't have to, and I didn't go. I mean, I just didn't like that kind of stuff. And for whatever reason, I'm starting to do stuff like that, you know. And then one of the things he did, he got me hooked up with a big book study at a guy's house. You know, there was and the guy was awesome. I mean, there's a whole big book study. There's a men's big book study. There were a bunch of guys. They were hooked up with one of the Atlanta Men's Workshop in Rock Eagle and just all that kind of stuff. And the Skyland group, he took me to groups where there were a lot of people with a lot of time. They'd been around for a long, long time. And Skyland became my home group for about 27 years. And, but, you know, and another thing too is when the guy started working with steps, you know, came to believe is truly a process. And I remember when he started saying that we were going to start working towards the third step, and you know, I mean, I got the picture on some of this third step stuff where you the idea where you got to you know, getting on your knees and talking about stuff. That was really not my cup of tea. But for whatever reason, he got me to read stuff out of the third step, and then after 30 days, actually it was about a couple of months sober, we did the third step prayer, one of the most awkward, uncomfortable things I've ever done since I've been in AA, you know, especially early on. Because this wasn't really what I'm used to, that, doing that kind of stuff. You know, when I asked him, I said, well, how do you know if it works? He says, well, that depends how honest you're on the fourth step. All right. Then he says, well, it's time to do the fourth step. Well, I had no idea that I had really, really good creative writing skills. You know, because when I did the fourth step, I just had a way of wording things. You know, well, only shared the stuff that I really wanted him to know anyway, you know. I thought I was trying to beat, somehow I thought I was beating the system, you know, so I did this inventory and I thought, okay, well, you know, we'll see if it works. You know, he probably didn't really care as long as I was sharing something, you know, but I remember when I got done with it, you know, I kind of thought, you know, I thought I kind of beat something, you know, the system or something, you know, and probably 6 months later, I ended up sharing the stuff I left off intentionally anyway. You know, so I kind of like cheated myself out of 6 months of feeling better about it, you know. But I don't know, life just kind of, you know, it's just been an awesome, you know, road. And also, you know, I never knew anything about a lot of things. I was young when I got here, but I didn't really date. I didn't really do a lot of anything, you know. And so I finally, I used to tell people, you know, I'm glad I never got credit when I was drinking because I'd have damn sure ruined it when I'm sober. You know, I'd have ruined it drinking. You know, if I'd have got it drinking. Well, I got it sober, and I ruined it sober. I ended up filing bankruptcy back in 91, you know. I was a person, too, that I lived in a lot of different places. I just never had a lot of anything, even for years after I got sober. So I just lived with, I'd rent rooms for people and do this kind of stuff. You know, finally, when I was a couple years sober, I called my dad at one time. I said, you know, if I could just come home and live for even a month until I can get this place. I tell him about this place, I get lined up. He's like, hell. He's like, hell no, you ain't coming home. I was like, shit. So I remember looking in the newspaper, finding a room for rent. You know, and ended up finding some place that night for like 9 months. But I ended up finding one place I lived for a couple years. But then I started this inventory with this sponsor of mine, right? And the inventory was like on relationships. And he said, you ever hear the infamous AA song? I'm like, no. He says, Mimi, me. I'm like, okay. 6 months later, I met a girl named Mimi. So, believe it or not, she wanted to marry me, so I married her, you know. And that's really how it worked. You know, and the thing is, she was morally, in her character, I mean, she didn't drink, drug, smoke, cuss, college graduate, grew up in singing in the church choir. It's completely unlike anybody I should be with anyway. You know, especially, that's, even her parents thought that. You know, and I was sober a couple of years, I was sober 6 years when I met her, you know. But tell you what, even then my mindset was just, my mindset wasn't on getting married and staying married. My mindset was, I didn't have a mindset with stuff like that. So I remember I was moving out of my place that I had found online. Online went around. I was living in this guy's house that I'd rented a room from him. I'm moving out of this guy's house to move in with the person I just married. And I'm telling this buddy of mine, I'm like, that's a nice-ass house. If I ever get divorced, I'll move right back in here. 18 months later, Frank! That's how long my marriage lasted, 18 months. You know, and the thing is, she came into Al-Anon. She loved Al-Anon. She loved this. But something was broken inside of me that didn't want to stay married. You know, I wanted my freedom. You know, whatever that freedom, whatever that meant, I wanted to get up and do whatever the hell I wanted. You know, I never really dated seriously for years. You know, just off and on, a little here and there and stuff like that. But you know, God works in mysterious ways. You know, and I got introduced to going to. I got introduced to going to stuff like the International's Conference and AA International. I've been to like four of these things. And if you haven't gone, they're amazing to go to. But I was going to this one international, you know, and I was playing around with doing this online dating stuff, you know, and And I went to the airport to go to Toronto, Canada, and I met this couple from Washington State, you know, and this couple, the guy had asked me, he was a guy that got sober like at 15, he was like 23 years sober, and he asked me, could I give him a ride to their hotel, and he was at a rent, because I had a rental car, and they didn't. I'm like, hey, not a problem, man. It turned out we were riding around, we hung out 4 or 5 hours, I let him off the hotel. His wife was Chinese, and he was an American guy. I let him off. I thought, man, as I was doing some online dating, I thought, you know what, that's pretty cool. I mean, his wife was attractive, friendly. I thought, when I get back to Atlanta, I'm going to do me some searches from Asian chicks. That was my mindset. And I did. Yeah, a month later, I met a girl that I ended up marrying. I've been married for 12 years. You know, and it's amazing how God works, you know, because when I met her, I was renting a room for a buddy of mine. And the thing is, at that particular time in my life that I actually met this person, I was making a lot of money. I was making really good money, a lot more than I ever made before. At the same time, but I was paying like $400 a month utilities included, because I like to spend my money the way I wanted to spend it until I met her. You know, next thing you know, I've been married 12 years and I own 2 houses in the suburbs. You know, and it's amazing how that works. You know, is that God has His plan, and so when He wants to move, He moves quickly. You know, and things have just taken off. I mean, you know, but anyhow, at some point, yeah, she is amazing. I can't imagine what my life would be without when she got put in my life. It just kind of sped everything up. It just, next thing you know, it had nothing to do with me. You know, I mean, she literally. I'm so bad with so many things. And I think God sometimes puts you with somebody that's really good at what you really suck at. You know what I mean? And I remember one time she says, if you can save $20,000 by this time next year, I will match it and we'll buy a house. I was making really good money. And I could have actually done that. Except I was in charge of my own money. You know? And a year later, I didn't have nothing. She's like, well, I'll buy my own damn house. And she did. I was like, she could have bought a house anytime she wanted to. Well, she had a plan for life. I didn't have a plan for nothing, you know. I mean, except for going to meetings, you know, trying to work with a few people and doing certain things. I learned how to, I really have to learn to look at myself where I came from, because people in AA, what I found is they come from so many different varieties of backgrounds. You know, I've sponsored guys that were more responsible when the middle of their using than I've ever been probably my entire life, you know, and the other way around as well, you know, and I don't know why that is, you know, but in my experiences, everything I was really bad at, my wife is extremely good at, and my life has taken off. I tell you, that doesn't mean she ain't pulled her hair out because of me, you know, which she has, you know, and still is, you know, but it's just weird how things work out, you know. And the same thing with my career. You know, I didn't have really much of a job. I mean, I just kind of bounced around a couple of different low-paying jobs. And before I even got an internship, and now, before I met her, weird things kind of lined up. And I ended up in the sign industry, which is what I'm doing now. And it's kind of just more like a hobby. You know, I can't believe I get to do what I'm doing now for a living. You know, sometimes I make good, sometimes I don't. But it's okay, you know. But as far as, you know what? And the thing is, the one thing about being sober for any length, I want to go back for a second because I didn't talk about this, is that 6 months after I got sober, my kid brother told me this was the NABA club, right? He came into AA right behind me. And after I got sober, I didn't mention AA, I kind of get sidetracked. When I was living with him, and I was a couple, I don't know, when I picked my white chip up, I went back to his house, and I was living with him and his wife, and he's sitting there smoking a joint, and said, hey, you want to hit this? Within a day or two, I moved back home with my parents for like the first 9 months I was sober. And their rule was no drinking or drugging. Well, a couple months later, him and his wife had it out. And he moved back home with my mom, and he got sober as well. At about 6 months, I was about 6 months sober when he got sober. And he stayed around about 2.5 years, you know. And the thing is, you know, our drinking was different. You know, I didn't think he was an alcoholic. I didn't know if he's an alcoholic. He had 3 DUIs. But all 3 of them were like fluke DUIs. It wasn't even like real bad drunk DUIs, you know. But he had 3 of them. But he stayed around a couple of years. I told my story for his first AA birthday. And I thought, hey, we're sober together forever, you know. But you know, for whatever reason, like I said, our drinking patterns were different, severely different. And And so after about 2.5 years, he decided the first wife left him. He met another girl. She smokes pot. He was a huge pothead that drank, you know. So he started smoking pot again. He started drinking again. In the next 10 years, he went from a pothead that drank to drinking that smoked pot. I'd never witnessed that happen that closely. And he just started smoking pot less and started drinking more. In his late 20s, started having blackouts. I don't know. I had blackouts when I was 13. You know, and I witnessed some of his close-up blackouts, you know, and they're really kind of weird to watch in person, you know, because I never watched myself have a blackout, you know. But, you know, he would pop back in AA every once in a while. And his last wife, he'd met her in AA, and she was more messed up than he was. When he was 34, he committed suicide. And his oldest daughter was 13 years old, and he had 4 kids, you know. That's just, you know, that's part of the reality we live in, you know. So what I found is for anybody to stay sober any length of time, at some point in their life, at some point in my life, my sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous has become the most important thing in my entire life. You know, and there's a lot of, you don't have so much time to speak about everything, but there's you know, and I have to live it like that, you know. And so my wife that I have now, being a different nationality, has challenged me with that a lot, you know. And I don't want to go into details of that, but you know, there's certain things that I have to do to stay here, you know, and I treasure that. You know, I cannot imagine my life today with you know, if I ever relapse. But you know, I was told before the meeting, a sponsor I had in the mid 90s, after many many years of not drinking, decided to smoke some pot, and I was like, I can't imagine that guy doing that. But you know, the reality is, I have to stay here and go to as many meetings as possible. And so today for myself, I still do most of the same things I did when I first got here. I try to go 4 to 5 meetings a week. I surround myself around people that hopefully have been here longer than him, but yeah, I've been here a pretty good while. But I try to put myself in the middle of some really strong AA people and meet as many new guys and work with them as I can, you know. But this is an amazing lifestyle, you know. I could not imagine my life any other way, you know. I tell you this also is I was told is you know, when you go to a meeting that have a lot of old timers, the one thing that they go through that they've all gone through lots of people dying from this stuff, you know. So if they're quicker to help straighten you out, you know what I'm saying? They don't want to see you die, you know. And what I've learned is nobody at AA wants to see anybody die from this. You know, I've seen lots of people die from this, you know. I've known lots of people about it. My brother's just one of them, you know. And it's a pretty serious thing, you know. And we have a handful of family members, you know, that have had issues with this, you know, in and out of the program, especially one. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Enjoyed that very much. Thanks again. Let's give another round of hands. Really good stuff. We've got one special medallion we're giving out tonight, but I'm going to get Tim to give out the regular chips.
Hey, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic.
That's great, Phil. Thanks a lot.
White chip is for anybody that wants to just stay sober. Give it a shot for 24 hours. Would anybody like to pick up a white chip tonight? Coming in or coming back? Come on up, buddy.
Hang around and talk with some folks after the meeting.
Anybody else want a white chip? You can have some. Anybody have 60 days? Oh, I'm sorry, 30 days. 30 days. Anybody have 30 days? Anybody have 60 days? 90 days? 6 months? Anybody have 9 months? Or a year or multiples? Congratulations on the chips you have.
Come up here, Mike. All right, it's a real honor to give my friend Mike his chip. I'll let him tell you how many years, and I'll let him tell you how he did it. But, you know, in the rooms we talk about doing the deal, and this guy does the deal, and he gets the results, and he's one of my best friends. I love him very much. Thanks, Mike. Congratulations.
Everybody, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Mike.
And other things.
This is 8. I started here 8 years ago, and I came every day, and I was just beaten down so badly that I listened to what people were telling me to do and did it. The days turn into months, and months turn into years, and, you know, now it's 8 years, and life is immeasurably better than I ever thought it could be. Thanks, Phil. I really enjoyed your story, by the way. That was great. I needed to hear that. Thanks.
That's good stuff.
First I slept, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Take me where the promise is.